not long after the church was established in the first century, the disciples came under great threats of persecution, and beyond that carried out through the loss of many lives because of their faith. In Acts chapter 8, Paul, who was then known as Saul of Tarsus, of course, brought a great persecution against the church. And as a result, Paul's disciples were scattered throughout the region of Judea. I would suspect if we could have lived in that period of time, we could appreciate more of what we have in the way of prosperity, in the way of conveniences. And when I look back at that, and I think under the circumstances that in which they met, or under which they met, none of those circumstances were good. Not only were there threats of their own lives, but also the places where they have to meet would be greatly inconvenient. They would meet sometimes perhaps in places that would be obscure and hidden from most people. People would not know where they were. And so it certainly was inconvenient. So I'm amazed that in our times we have grown so soft that we, at the least inconvenience, feel as though we cannot worship God as we should. These are mere circumstances that come and go and they pass, and they should be to us insignificant and certainly not something that's beyond our toleration. And let's be grateful for what we do have. We're starting now in a section of the Bible in 2 Kings that is going to be in many parts very tedious. And it's going to require of you, if you want to understand this part of the Bible, that you really apply yourself. And it would be good if you would memorize the kings of Israel and the kings of Judah. Now, I've not pushed you on this. I've given you a lot of leniency, and I've not required this of you, that you might stay a member here if you don't memorize these kings. But it would be good for you. And I realize it will take some time, and you say, well, it just doesn't seem to be important. But to understand the history of this section, it would really help you. And I say that while I myself am still working on the memorization process. Especially as we probably are more exposed to the kings right now of Israel than we are of Judah. Now, I pointed out to you that many times when one king begins to rule, it's related to the time in which the other king in the other kingdom is ruling. So when you look tonight and you find that Jehoram begins to rule in the certain year of Jehoram, then you realize that you have a king in Israel, you have also a king in Judah that's named Jehoram. And sometimes they're known here as Joram. And so that can all be very confusing if you don't have all of this straight. And I have worked diligently trying to keep it straight in my own mind. And I know how difficult it is for us to go through this section and try to keep it all together. Because it can get very confused and very muddled. As we begin the second book of Kings, of course, in order, in historical order, it follows from the first book of Kings. And at the end of the first book of Kings, then we find the prophecy that was made in Ahab. And let me pick up some of the verses in chapter 22. In verse 24, Zedekiah the son of Chenaah came near, spoke to Micaiah on the cheek. Micaiah was the prophet. And then in verse 28, Micaiah said, "If thou return and all in peace, Jehovah hath not spoken by me." And he said, "Hear ye people, all of ye." And so the king of Israel certainly is predicted to die. Now we find them going into battle. This is at Ramoth-Gilead in verse 29. And it says that in verse 32, the captains of the chariot saw Jehoshaphat, that they said, "Surely it is the king of Israel." And they turned aside to fight against him. And Jehoshaphat cried out. And he had been disguised, but he cried out. And then we find that a certain man drew back his bow and at venture smote the king of Israel between the joints of the armor. And as he was dying, then he told his chariot driver to drive away. The blood spilled out in the chariot. And then as we come down, it says in verse 37, the king died, was brought to Samaria. They buried the king in Samaria. And they washed the chariot by the pool of Samaria, and the dogs licked up his blood. Now this is exactly what had been prophesied, that this was going to happen. The dogs would lick up his blood. So Ahab slept with his father, and Ahaziah, his son, reigned in his stead. Now that's how we end with the beginning of the rule of Ahaziah and with the death of Ahab. Of all the kings of Israel, you will not find one who is identified by God as being a worse king, more immoral, and having a greater negative influence on the land of Israel than Ahab did. And you remember when you go back and look at what we studied, the reason for that, one of the reasons was that not only did he himself worship idol gods, but it says above that he married Jezebel. And she was of the Sidonians, and she brought down to worship especially the Baal gods. And then this was infiltrating all the land of Israel. She had all of her prophets there. And the worship of Baal became very prolific in the land of Israel. Ahab is identified in that way. Now we're going to try to go through chapter 10. I don't know that we'll have time to do that tonight. But the reason for doing that is because there was a prophecy in reference to the passing of all of the house of Ahab. Because of his great immorality and idolatry, God had said that not only would Ahab die and the dogs lick up his blood, but he would see to it that all of his house was ended, all of his children. And chapter 10 is kind of a good dividing point because it brings that prophecy to pass. Now remember also as we finish the book of 1 Kings that Ahab is dead, Jezebel is still alive, and probably is occupying some house in Jezreel. And so we're going to pass through several years of history before we come to her death. Now God has also predicted her death. She's going to die. And there's a certain way in which she is going to die as well. So let's begin now. Open your Bibles to 2 Kings chapter 1. And we have picking up with where Ahab had died. And Ahaziah began to rule. And it says that he fell through the lattice in his upper chamber and he was sick in Samaria. Well, these kings are always concerned about, am I going to live and am I going to die? And they would consult their prophets that they might see or have some special insight. And so Ahaziah sends some of his servants along the way, not down to Elisha, but to the prophets of Baal. And God, so now he sends the prophets on their way to the Baal. And the angel of God appears unto Elijah, the Tishbite, and says, go meet these messengers and tell them that Ahaziah is going to die. He's not going to live. And so Elijah meets them on the way, tells them this, and they turn back to King Ahaziah and come back to him and tell him what the prophet said. They didn't know who he was. And so Ahaziah says, what did he look like? And they answered, he was a hairy man, and girt with a girdle of leather about his loins. And he said, it is Elijah the Tishbite. Now, all of these old kings knew a lot about Elijah. Elijah had been their opponent. You remember the conflicts that he had with, especially with Ahab. And many of the chapters in chapter 1 Kings were occupied with the continuing conflict between Ahab especially and Jezebel, his wife, and Elijah the prophet. Elijah was not a nice person. I don't mean that he wasn't a good person, but I mean he didn't dress nicely. He was not of the aristocrats. He did not belong in the king's court. And you find like him when you come to John the Baptist in the New Testament that there is a similarity even in their dress besides their spirit itself. And he's known. He was just a prophet. He was out everywhere from place to place, and he certainly was a person who was kind of crude as you might look at him. But I'll tell you what about Elijah. You didn't have to worry about where Elijah stood. Whatever God said for him to do it, Elijah did it. And he did it with great courage. Sometimes he got despondent. Sometimes he got discouraged. But you find him standing sometimes, at least in his own estimation, by himself against great odds. And yet he would say what God told him to say. Well, after this, the king sends out some 50 men with the captain. And as they come to Elijah, then Elijah answers, if I be a man of God, let fire come down from heaven, consume thee. Fire came down, consumed the first 50. Send another 50 men. If I be the man of God, let fire come down, fire consumes the second 50. Well, now you know word's going to get out that this is not a popular place to be. It's not a good thing to do to go down to Elijah. But a third captain is sent with a third 50, and as he approaches Elijah, he pleads for his life. He begs for the mercy. And so Elijah has mercy upon him. But he tells him to go back to Ahaziah and that he is going to die. He's not going to get up from his bed. So in verse 17, He died according to the word of Jehovah, which Elijah had spoken. And Jehoram began to reign in his stead in the second year of Jehoram. Now that's where it becomes confusing, because this Jehoram is the son of Jehoshaphat. And the other Jehoram if I remember correctly, the son of Ahab. So you have two Jehorams who are ruling coexistent with each other, and whose rule is over that one. As you begin the second chapter, it is the time in which Elijah is going to pass from this life. And our children have learned this story. They learned about Elijah being caught up in the whirlwind, the chariots of fire, and the mantle falling on Elisha. And they may pick up this story without understanding where it fits into the overall scheme of the whole Bible. So what we're trying to do is fit all of this information, sometimes that we gather as children, fit it all together in the place where it belongs historically. Now, Ahab is dead, Ahaziah has died, and Elijah is now going to be caught up to God. Elijah, you remember, was translated. He did not die like Enoch. He did not die, but he's caught up in the whirlwind. Interesting thing about it, you find it associated with Elijah, and Elisha is to be the one who's going to follow him as a prophet. And they're going along the way, first of all, from Gilgal, and Elijah says to Elisha, "Tarry here, I pray you. God has called me to Bethel." Elisha says, "No, I'm going with you." And so they go to Bethel, and then Elijah says, "God's called me to Jericho, so you stay here." He says, "No, I'm going with you to Jericho." So they go down to Jericho, and then Elijah says, "God called me to go to Jordan. Now stay here." Elijah said, "No, I'm going with you." So he's following right along. And then the statement that's made in verse 9 of chapter 2, it came to pass when they were gone over that Elijah said unto Elisha, "Ask what I shall do for thee before I am taken from thee." Elijah knows he's going to pass. Elisha said, "I pray thee, let a double portion of thy spirit be upon thee." Now, what he's asking for is very admirable, because he's to take the place of Elijah. And as strong as Elijah was, he says, "Let me be twice as strong. Let that spirit of independence, that spirit of courage and of faithful service, let me have a double portion of that." And as you go on, you pick up little tidbits about the history of Elisha that's very interesting. And some very unusual things occurred. Last part of this chapter, one thing I like about it, that we'll point out as we get there. Now, as they've been going over Jordan, Elijah had taken his mantle and smote the waters, and the waters separated. Now Elisha, after Elijah's been caught up into heaven by the whirlwind, he sees the chariots of fire and the horses of fire and heaven's party asunder. And Elijah is gone, and now it becomes his responsibility to be the prophet to speak for God in Israel. As he's crossing back over, he also takes the mantle, and that would be kind of like an outer garment of sorts that was worn by the prophet, and identified him as a prophet. And he smote the waters just like Elijah had in verse 14, and the waters parted. And the sons of the prophets, and when they see this, their conclusion is, in verse 15, "The spirit of Elijah doth rest on Elisha." That's what Elijah wanted. Not just some of it, he says, but "Let a double portion rest upon." Now, the men, the prophets that are there, they're concerned that perhaps Elijah has been caught up by God, but he's off somewhere and hidden, and they can't find him. They said, "Let us send some men to go see him." Well, Elisha knows where Elijah is. He says, "Don't go." But they persisted. And finally said, "Okay, go." And they went and looked, and they came back, and they said, "We can't find him." He said, "Didn't I tell you not to go?" Then the interesting part of this, in the city, or at least in the surroundings, evidently of Jericho near Jordan, the waters are very bad. And it says, "Because of this, the land miscarrieth, casteth forth its fruit." I don't know if actually because of something that was in the water that was causing a miscarriage on the part of the women, or if it was something that was just simply describing the condition of the land. But anyway, he took some salt and cast it into the water, and then the waters were pure. Now here's an interesting part. You remember this. If you don't remember anything else, you're going to remember this. And I'll tell you why I remember. A friend of mine, where we lived in Lufkin, was just as bald as he could be. And we had kind of a running battle, just a wit battle between us. And one day he came up to me and he said, "Did you know that grass doesn't grow on a busy street. And you get the implication of that, don't you? And I said, yes, but it doesn't grow on rock either. And he thought about that. He came back the next week and he said, did you know that there were 44 young lads that made fun of Elisha because he was bald, and that two she-bears came out of the woods and ate them, tore them up? I said, yeah, I knew that. And he kind of got the last word in. And there certainly is a warning. And you won't forget this, because as they're going along the way, these young lads do not show proper respect for Elisha as a prophet. Go up, thou bald head. Go up, thou bald head. Be careful what you say about bald people. It can be very dangerous. And then the 42 are rent in two, and he goes on his way. Now, chapter 3, we have the beginning, or back to the idea of the rule of Jehoram, which we picked up ending chapter, or the first Kings, first letter of Kings, and starting in the second book of Kings. Jehoram, the son of Ahab. Now, here is the son of Ahab called Jehoram, but also the son of Judah is called Jehoram, and he's the son of Jehoshaphat. You got that straight. So keep it straight. But it says of him that he did that which was evil in the sight of Jehovah, but not like his father and like his mother. For he put away the pillar of Baal that his father had made. But it says he still cleaved in the sins of Jeroboam. You remember some time ago I told you there was a key that you could always look at when you identify the sins of the kings of Israel. When it came to idolatry, and it talked about how great that idolatry was, they would always go back. The writer would go back and pick up and says he's like the king Jeroboam that identified it. Because why? Jeroboam introduced the idolatry, building the altars at Dan at Bethel, and practicing idolatry to keep the nation of Israel separate from their brothers and sisters in the king of Judah. We have under his rule the rebellion of the king of Moab. And then this is before Jehoram actually begins to rule in Judah. And this time is when Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, is reigning. And they make a confederation. They agree together that they're going to deal with the king of Moab. And he says in verse 7, I will go up, and I am as thou art, my people as thy people, my horses as thy people. We're going to confederate together. And so you have Jehoram and you have Jehoshaphat as they confederate together to deal with the rebellion of Moab. But as they go up, and actually the king of Edom seems to join in this, you have three kings. But it's a very desert land, and they don't have any water. So they're out there, and they're going to die, and Moab is going to be victorious. He's going to defeat the kings just because of the natural order of things in the world. And Elisha then is called for by the king of Israel. The situation is explained to him, and he says, dig some trenches, make this valley full of trenches, in verse 16. That'd be an unusual thing to do, because this is not a place where you find a lot of water. And he's saying, dig some trenches. Well, that certainly is going to require some faith on their part. But he says when you do it, the water's going to come. It's not going to come as a result of rain. You're not going to see the rain, but the waters will fill the trenches. And so they do that. And then we come to the next part of it in verse 20. Came to pass in the morning about the time of the offering of the oblation. Behold, there came water by the way of Edom, and the country was filled with water. Now, we would understand in our environment here that if it rained back up in the north and the west, and the rivers are running from the north and the west down to the south and the east as they go down to the Gulf, and it rains back up there, and it rains a lot, then our creeks and our rivers are going to get full here. We may not see the rain, but and that's what happened, evidently, that God caused it to rain further back up the way, and the waters were filled, the trenches were filled with the water. Now, as we come down to the last of chapter 3, and this tells you somewhat about the terrible, cruel nature of some of these kings. And this king was defeated, the king of Moab. They rose up against him. They beat down the cities. He saw this water, and he thought it's blood. All these kings, all these people then have been defeated, and the trenches just full of blood. So he rises up to muster against them and to destroy them, but instead he finds that the forces are there, and he himself is defeated. And verse 27, he took his eldest son that should have reigned in his stead and offered him for a burnt offering upon the wall. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine a person that is so inhuman, that has so little compassion for his own family, that he would take his own son and offer him for a burnt offering? And this is depicting very much the immoral condition, the depraved, degraded condition of a lot of these kings and nations round about you. And also you find similar circumstances, perhaps not to the same degree, but in many of the ungodly nations of our time who have so little respect for life, even for the lives of their own families. And we find other events where people, even women, will destroy their own household or part of their own household to preserve one to rule. In chapter 4, we're introduced to the widow. And again, the story that the children may learn, and there's a lot of stories in this that you'll find in Bible class literature. The woman who is the Shunammite woman. And first of all, she comes and she says, "My husband is dead. I have no way of making a living. There's no one to provide for me. I don't have anything. And this, I owe this great debt." And Elisha says, "What do you have?" And she says, "I've just got a pot of oil. That's all I've got." And he says, "Go out and borrow all these vessels that you can get." And she went out and borrowed them. And then she began to pour the oil from her vessel into those vessels. And they were all filled and until there were no more vessels available. It came to pass in verse 6, it says, that she said to her son, "Bring me yet a vessel." He said to her, "There is not a vessel more," and the oil stayed. Now God provided for her through the efforts of Elisha. And this again was a signal. It was a sign of Elisha being the prophet of God. She sold the oil, paid her debt, and then we have the story continuing as Elisha passes by her house, and she and her husband, in verse 10, it says, "Let us make thee, I pray thee, a little chamber on the wall, pass to Shunem." Now, okay, let me proceed on. I'm going to come back and make a point on this later on. She said to her husband, "Behold, now I perceive that this is a holy man of God that passeth by us continually." And she said, "Let us make, I pray, the little chamber on the wall. Let us set for him there a bed and a table and a seat and a candlestick, and it shall be, when he cometh to us, he shall turn in thither." And so there was provision made for Elisha in this place. And then, as we come down to verse 14, it says, what then is to be done for her? And Gehazi said, "Verily she hath no son, her husband is old. Call her." And then Elisha says, "You're going to have a son." And she says, "Not so, Lord, because I'm old and I cannot have a son." And yet she conceived and bore the son. And then of all things, in verse 19, the child was out of the field as he had grown up. And he said, "My head, my head, carry him to his mother." And as he was taken, and his mother brought him, set her on her knees, and at noon he died. Well, this is greatly distressing to this woman. In fact, she explains to Elisha when she finally meets him, "I didn't ask for a son, but you gave me a son. And now my son is dead." So she's greatly distressed. She says to her servant, "Saddle my ass, my donkey, and drive quickly, and don't take any compassion on me, and I'll stop you if it's too difficult." And they came to Mount Carmel. You find Elisha then moving from place. It's quite a ways from the Jordan River in Jericho up to Mount Carmel. But that's where Elisha is. And as she comes to him, she's deeply vexed because her son is dead. And this is how then she speaks to Elisha about the death of her son. And Elisha sends before him Gehazi, the servant, "Come to the house and lay my staff upon him." But as they do so, it still does not revive his life. And when Elisha comes to the house, the child is dead. And the story picks up now in verse 34. That he came in, he lay upon the child, put his mouth upon his mouth, his eyes upon his eyes, his hands upon his hands. He stretched upon him, and the flesh of the child waxed warm. Then he returned and walked to and fro the house, and went up and stretched himself upon him. And the child sneezed 7 times, and the child opened his eyes. Now we have the reviving of this son that belonged to this Shunammite woman. In verse 38 and following, we find Elisha again came to Gilgal, and there was a great drought. And this is a story I've heard preachers use as a basis for sermons. They talk about there's death in the pot. There's death in the pot. And the illustration is, and again, you won't forget this because I'm sure you maybe heard it preached about, but the point is that you can have a lot of good stuff in a pot, and all you have to do is just add a little bit of the gourds that were gathered that were poisonous, and you've ruined the whole pottage. You've ruined the whole mess of it. And so as they eat it, they say there's death in the pot. And there are several illustrations that you can use from that if you want to preach that sermon. You can take just a little bit of something that's bad and put it in something good, and you've corrupted the whole thing. You can even take a good congregation, and you can put a little leaven in there that's bad, and you corrupt the whole congregation in time. That's certainly a figure. And I'll leave that to your imagination if you want, you men want to develop a sermon about that. It can preach pretty good. I've heard some good preaching about it. In fact, I think Oliver Murray may have something like that. I've heard him use illustrations like that. Chapter 5 is very familiar to us. The story about Naaman the leper. And if I were to ask our teachers, have you ever taught this to our children, I think that most of them would raise their hand and say, yes, we have. And they have taught it. And again, it's difficult for children to see the overall view of everything. And in fact, as adults, we sometimes don't get the overall view. We see just a part of history without understanding where it fits into all of history. Well, now let's go back and think about what's taking place as 2 Kings begins. You have, first of all, the death of Ahab, the beginning of the rule of Ahaziah. And you're going to find some interplay between the nations round about. You're going to find the rebelling of Moab. You're going to find Edom involved in this as they confederate evidently with Israel and Judah. And you're also going to find implied that in this period of time, because these nations were constantly warring and raiding against each other, that Syria, and that's to the north, the nation to the north, and Ben-Hadad is king of Syria this time, that there has been raiding down into the land of Israel. That's just south of the nation of Syria. And so when you pick up with Naaman, you find identified him as the captain of the host of the Syrian army. So you see how all of these nations round about this time are fighting with each other, and on occasions which is beneficial, that Israel and Judah will confederate together. Otherwise, they're natural enemies. They fight against each other. But this is a story that fits into this time frame. Naaman was a leper, a little maiden who had been captured in one of the raids by the Syrian army. Was in the house of Naaman and serving in some capacity. And she gave word or said that if her captain, her master, had been down the land of Israel, that there was a prophet there who could cure him of leprosy. And this began the proceedings in which, through the proper channels, the proper political channels, Naaman is sent by the king of Syria down to the king of Israel. That's the wrong place because the healing is not with the king of Israel. In fact, is the king of Israel stands as one who actually is an opponent of Elisha, not at all in harmony with what Elisha is and what Elisha stands for. But as Naaman comes to the king of Syria, Then the king of Israel says he's trying to pick a quarrel with me. But then you'll find that in verse 7. But word comes from Elisha. And then he goes down to the house of Elisha. And you see then how Elisha fits in this as the successor to Elijah. And he's the prophet that's dealing with the immorality of the people in primarily the land of Israel, sometimes in Judah. And as Naaman comes down, Elisha sends a servant down and says, Go and wash in the Jordan River, dip thyself seven times, and thou will be clean. Now Naaman is a man who's not prone to being shown disrespect. And he sees this as something that is offensive to him. He had in his mind a picture about how Elisha was going to take care of that. He was going to come down and lay his hands on the leprosy and call the name of his God, something that would be very showy and displayed. And he didn't do that. And so our scripture tells us he turned away in wrath and started back to his native land, because if certainly there was power in water, Abana and Pharpar are far better as far as the cleanliness of water than the Jordan is. And again, his thinking is distorted because he doesn't understand that it's not the water, but it's the power of God, the God of Elisha, that's going to do the cleansing. But his servant reasons with him and says, if the prophet had commanded thee some great thing, wouldn't you have done that? He's a reasonable man. And he thinks, yes, I would have done that. Now, he hasn't required of you very much, then why not do that? So based upon that, he turns and goes back to the Jordan River, dips himself seven times, and comes forth clean. Well, journey back to Elisha's house. He realizes that it's the God of Elisha that's done this. Not in the Jordan River, but in the power of the God of Elisha. And so he wants to give Elisha all of these goods he brought with him. Came to pay a great price. Elisha says, no, I don't want that. He's not a man who serves God because of material things. And so Naaman turns to go back to his homeland. And as he's journeying along the way, you find Gehazi. And that's the name that we've seen several times before. Because he's Elisha's servant. And he begins to think about this. And so he runs after Naaman. And he says to him in verse 22, my master has sent me. That's, remember our lesson this morning? The words that come forth, this was a lie. This was not the truth. And Elisha sees this. He says, wasn't my spirit with you when you ran after him? And he says, give me a talent of silver. And Naaman presses upon him. He urged him, take two talents of silver and two bags and two changes of raiment, laid upon him and his servants, and they buried them before him. And he came to the hill, came to his own land, to his own house, and put his possessions now in his house. And he came back to Elisha. And Elisha says, because of what you have done the leprosy, therefore Naaman shall cleave to thee. So Gehazi became a leper. He inherited, because of his sin, the leprosy of Naaman. In chapter 6, now we are acquainted. Again, you see, we've moved from the Moabites and also the association with the Edomites, the confederation between Israel and Judah, and just a brief look at one individual in the time frame of these events. But now we're going to come to the Syrians themselves and their invading forces. First of all, we have before that a story that, again, you probably have taught your children about the floating axe head. It starts by saying, the sons of the prophets say, behold, the place where we dwell is too straight for us. So they want to go out and build another place, and they're going to stay there. They go down to Jordan, and they're cutting wood, evidently, and the axe head falls off the axe and goes into the water. And the servant is greatly distressed because it was a borrowed one. And he's lost this, which evidently would be very precious to him. And then it says, the man of God said, where it fell it, he showed it. The place, he cut down a stick, cast it in thither, and made the iron to swing. Well, that's not an ordinary thing. Why do you think it'd be recorded in history? Just to tell your children about? No, it impresses upon us over and over again that Elisha certainly is a man of God. It's one of the signs that indicate that he was certainly of God. But in verse 8, the king of Syria was warring against Israel. He took counsel with his servants, saying, in such and such a place shall I be encamped. And every time he did this, the king of Israel would escape. And he couldn't understand this. How does he know where I'm going to be? And then one of his servants spoke up and said, it's by Elisha, the prophet, because he tells the king before what's going to happen. And so if you say you're going to fight here, then the king flees away from that place, and you can't fight him. And as a result of that, you have this great army that marches down to the house of Elisha. And early in the morning, it says, a host of horses and chariots was round about the city. And Elisha's servant said, alas, my master, how shall we do? He answered, fear not, for they that are with us are more than they that are with thee. How can he say that? Because he fights with the army of God. You have Jehovah of hosts. And that's the word that describes the multitude of those who are the Lord's army. Now that's a good point for us to remember. Sometimes we feel like perhaps in our fight against what's wrong that we're so much in the minority. And in reality we are, from the standpoint of the forces of people about us. We're by far the minority. But if we can just remember what Elisha said here, the forces that are with us are more than the forces with them. He opened the eyes then of his servant that he might see. And he looks upon the mountains, and the mountains are full of horses and chariots of fire round about Elisha. Elisha prayed God, and he smote the people. They were blinded. He leads them down to Samaria and says, Elisha's not here, and takes them down to Samaria. And they're in the middle of the army of Israel. And he allows their eyes to be opened, and they see that they're now captive. And the king of Samaria, the king of Israel, wanted Elisha to allow him to smite them. They're the enemy. And now we have this advantage. But he says, no, Don't smite them. Don't take advantage of them. And during this period of time, you found that there's a great drought. And evidently this has to do with Ben-Hadad and his efforts in raiding down into the land of Israel, but probably from some natural sources and possibly something that Elisha himself has predicted, partially in response to the idolatry of the land. But it's described terribly. It says in verse 25, there was a great famine in Samaria, and behold, they besieged it until an ass's head was sold for 4 score pieces of silver, and the fourth part of a calf of doves done for 5 pieces of silver. Nothing to eat. So scarce that the people would just pay whatever they had for just the slightest morsel of food. In this context, again, you find how degenerate people can truly become. There is a problem between the two women, and they describe it as they appear before the king of Israel in this fashion. We agree, one woman said, that today we would eat my son, and tomorrow we would eat hers. And we boiled my son and did eat him. And I said to her on the next day, give thy son that we may eat him, and she hath hid her son. It came to pass when the king heard the word of the woman that he rent his clothes. And you can understand the anguish he would feel. If he had any sense of rulership at all, and there was some good there. But the very idea that women would take their own children and become so hungry that they would agree together that we'd eat my son today and we'll eat your son tomorrow. This woman doesn't have any scruples when she kind of says, well, we ate my son, but now she's hit her son and we can't eat him. The king is very distraught by that. And he then says that he would like to kill Elisha. He rent his clothes. He had sackcloth upon his face. He said in verse 31, God do so to me, and more so if the head of Elisha, the son of Shaphat, shall stand on him this day. He sees Elisha as the problem of all this. Elisha is just the servant of God. And then as we proceed into chapter 7, we see then the prediction made by Elisha that tomorrow about this time, chapter 7, verse 1, a measure of fine flour shall be sold for a shekel, as opposed to the things that would relate to your least desirable things to eat, the head of a donkey and the dung of a dove. And sold for so much, but now food is going to become so plentiful it'll be sold for such a little amount. 2 measures of barley for a shekel, the gave of Samaria. Interestingly enough, the captain on whose hand the king leaned, he evidently is in charge of the goods and distribution and care for the people. He said, behold, if Jehovah should make windows in heaven, might this thing be? He said, behold, thou shalt see it with thine eyes and shall not eat thereof. Interesting how God's providence is going to work in this. Because we see the Syrian army now camped about Samaria and this great drought and the famine is caused as a result of the besieging. But it says in verse 6, the Lord had made the host of Syrians to hear the noise of chariots. There weren't any chariots out there. And a noise of horses, but there weren't any horses out there. The noise of a great host, but there wasn't an army out there. And they said to one to another, lo, the king of Israel hath hired against us the kings of the Hittites and the kings of the Egyptians to come upon us. But what's happening is God has caused this, and they imagine this, and they get afraid, and they flee, and they leave behind all of their goods, all of the food. And then there are 4 lepers that enter into the picture, and their disposition is, well, we might as well go out and die by the hands of the Syrians as well as to die from starvation. And so they go out, they find the camp empty. And they begin to loot the camp, and they go back in to tell the king, and the king says, no, that's just a trick. They know we're hungry, and they've gone perhaps out of the ways, and when we go out, then they're going to capture us and going to kill us. So they sent out kind of a group of people to investigate, found out truly that the Syrians were gone. Drop down to verse 16. It says, the people went out and plundered the camp of the Syrians, so a measure of fine flour was sold for a shekel, and 2 measures of barley for a shekel according to the word of Jehovah. God works things out. Even now, it's illustrated in our time, I think, God's providence, though we may not always see these events. But this passage, along with many other passages of the Bible, tell us that God is in control of events. The interesting thing about this, also as it was predicted by Elisha, in verse 19, The captain answered the man of God and said, "Now behold, if Jehovah should make windows in heaven, might such a thing be?" He said, "Behold, thou shalt see it with thine eyes, but shall not eat thereof." It came to pass even so upon him, for the people trod upon him in the gate, and he died. It seems that as they are so ready to get out to get food, they're so hungry, he's in the way, and they just run over him, and he dies. Just like Elisha said it would happen. Well, I'm sure having a good time, and my time is up. Fast time. We'll pause there. I know that you've been very patient. You've listened very carefully. And we'll pick up in chapter 8 and proceed on as far as we can. But again, do some free reading. It will help you to keep all of this straight. And as you do, again, memorize the kings like you have Rehoboam, and you have Nadab, and you have Baasha, and then you have Elah, and then you have Zimri, and Omri, and Ahab, and then you have Jehoram, and Ahaziah, and that brings us to where we are. Is that right, Jimmy? Okay, Jimmy's my authority on this. Those are the kings of Israel. Now on the other side you have the kings of Judah, and memorize them as well. They're not quite as many as you come down to this point in time, starting with Rehoboam, and Abijah, and Asa, and I forgot the others, but I'll get them straight. Okay, let's close our study now by offering an invitation. If, perchance, there are those who may have been listening to what God has said and something has impressed you, we're not just reading history for the sake of learning history, Bible history, but we want to point out how God works in the history of mankind. In the midst of times that are bad, terrible times, and yet you see some good, you see and are encouraged by men like Elijah, and men like Elisha. And those are certainly good role models that we can point to and say, I want to have the spirit of Elijah. I'd like to have the double portion that Elisha had. Because I see in that the commendation of God. Again, by comparison. Do you think their circumstances were comfortable in their service to God? When they would sometimes flee from place to place, as they were pursued, like Ahab was pursued by Jezebel, going to kill you because of what you did to my prophets. And yet, under these adverse circumstances, they remained very faithful. It wasn't convenient to serve God, and many times it's not convenient. And if we serve God from convenience, it's for the wrong reason. We should serve God because of our faith. And our faith then overcomes the inconveniences. And they say, these things are not important. Not important. The thing is, that's important. We're here to serve God. We want to learn about God, more about Him, learn His will, and give ourselves totally to His service as we obey. So once you come, if you need to tonight, to obey Him in putting on Jesus and being baptized, or if you need to repent and come back in some sin you've done, something that you need to take care of in a public way as a Christian, as we stand and sing, we ask you to respond.